Typically, a mutation that deletes a genetic letter is catastrophic to a virus. Our cells read genetic letters 3 at a time to choose a new building block to add to a growing protein. A deletion of one genetic letter can entirely scramble the instructions for a viral protein so that it cannot form a functional shape. But Dr. Duprex and his colleagues found that the coronaviruses in the patients could lose genetic letters and yet stay viable. The secret: the viruses lost genetic letters in sets of 3. Instead of destroying the genetic recipe for a viral protein, the mutations sniped out one or more amino acids. As much as Dr. Duprex despises the pandemic, he finds it hard not to admire the elegance of these mutations. "It's so cool, it's brilliant," he said. Having found these deletion mutations in viruses from one person, Dr. Duprex and his colleagues wondered how common they were. Searching public databases of coronavirus genomes, they discovered that deletions were surprisingly widespread. "It's happening independently in different parts of the world," Dr. Duprex said. "All the deletions, it turns out, only arise in one region, the spike protein." Dr. Duprex and his colleagues found that deletions in the spike gene didn't prevent the coronavirus from infecting cells.
Iran Today.
He was not the first Iranian scientist to be assassinated in the past decade, but he was a pillar of Iran's scientific development and services for military and even medical purposes. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was ambushed in a weekend mountainous resort off Tehran on Friday, the 7th of November. Drag America into an unnecessary war and get it to set the rest of West Asia ablaze too. And why? Just to hold on to your own illegitimate existence. It's not proven, of course, that said scientist was assassinated by Israel, but the evidence is tangible and the motive no secret. But why now? And will it have been worth the effort? For answers, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. It's probable that Trump will be a single-term president, and if Biden takes office in the coming months, as it is assumed by his campaign slogans, he might return to the Iran nuclear deal and try to make U.S.'s approach different to that of Trump's and pick up talks with Iran. Now, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has said loud and clear there must be no return to the previous nuclear agreement. What better motive for killing off Iran's elites and military scientists, especially with America on your side? Kill him off, provoke Iran, get America to counter-react, and there go any hopes for talks. Mr. Ruivaran is a Middle East analyst, always with historic detail handy to support his comments. Let's hear him out.
The goal behind the assassination of yet another prominent Iranian scientist seems pretty straightforward. But what would you say it is?
In my opinion, there are two goals behind this assassination.
It's a general goal that those seeking to restrict Iran's military industry have stepped in to turn their demands into an operational stage and thus assassinate the father of Iran's military industry. This has been a large-scale goal. The name of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh has already been mentioned by the Mossad and the CIA. The second goal was tactical. They seek to force Iran to make a rash reaction to this event. Basically, Mr. Trump is working with Israel to make Iran do something that would make it fundamentally impossible to return to the deal and prevent a possible Biden administration from returning to the deal.
President Trump has been using his first term's last days to impose a new sanction a week on Iran. That is just to make it all that much harder for a possible Biden administration to return to normalcy with this country. But be ready for an unexpected spin to the true story. Mr. Izadi here is professor of international studies.
I think Mr. Netanyahu is trying to do a favor for President-elect Biden. You know, they know each other for many years. Netanyahu calls Mr. Biden an old friend and part of his family. And what they are trying to do is to create a setting for when Biden becomes president to have leverage against Iran.
So Israel is aiming to help the U.S. bring a weakened Iran to the negotiating table. But what if they get more than they've asked for? Because attacking a fifth and sixth scientist on Iranian soil could provoke an Iranian attack on Israel, hence inviting U.S. intervention in the region yet again. Iran has promised retaliation. It has retaliated in past against the U.S. Israel should be a lot easier. It's to be seen how and when Iran might do so, so as not to play into foul hands, however. Mr. Tajik joined us by Skype. To hear his experienced views is worth every moment of struggling with the connection.
With such moves, they try to force Iran to react. The next goal is to make Iran play into this scenario of the Zionist regime in Saudi Arabia and the Hebrew Arab faction. This will not happen. And naturally, the Islamic Republic will not set goals and actions based on the scenarios designed by others, but will act on its own plans to achieve its goals.
It is noteworthy that Iranian Parliament's first legal reaction to the assassination was to change the strategic action for lifting of sanctions, single urgency motion to double urgency motion, with an absolute majority of votes on November the 29th, 2020, in order to speed up action. The motion had been presented earlier and was passed on Tuesday, December the 1st, with 248 yeas. The motion has 9 provisions. Some important provisions are that the Nuclear Energy Organization must produce and store 120 kilograms of 20% enriched uranium annually, must produce 500 kilograms of uranium at different levels of enrichment for peaceful purposes once a month, and must reverse the Arak reactor back to its pre-JCPOA condition. Also, the government is obligated to report in 3 months from the passing of this motion on the compliance of other parties to the JCPOA. Should results not be satisfactory, the government must halt practice of the additional protocol of the NPT. Ms. Fallahi of the Parliamentary National Security Committee explains further.
Regarding this double agency motion, I should say that we didn't propose it in Parliament under spur of the moment. We had prepared it some 3 months ago, way before the assassination, as a reaction to the non-compliance of the 4+1 countries. It was approved as a single agency motion. Then after this unfortunate occurrence, we approved it as a double agency motion to expand our nuclear scientific capabilities. It is completely peaceful and in full compliance with the JCPOA's Articles 36 and 37, which state, should other parties to the deal not fulfill their commitments, we can also reduce our commitments as long as they have not returned to compliance. It is based on what those countries signed themselves.
The website Israel Hayom published a bold headline 29th November that read, "Iran's Tafia makes the world a safer place." It refers to the assassinations of Qasem Soleimani and Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, both recognized as martyrs in Iran. Such headlines coming from Israel sound like confessions, especially because Benjamin Netanyahu in April 2018 did say, "Remember this name," referring to Fakhrizadeh, as if putting a target on the scientist's back. For a glimpse into the more credible accounts of how the crime actually happened, we've got Mr. Abedin here with us in the studio. Mohan Abedin is a political analyst for Press TV. Welcome to the studio. Thanks for joining the program. Do feel free to begin your account whenever.
On the morning of Friday, 30th of November, one of Iran's leading scientists and a pioneer in nuclear-related research was transiting through the mountain retreat of Absad, situated nearly 100 kilometers east of the capital city, Tehran. While there are several versions as to what precisely unfolded on the main boulevard of Absad on that fateful morning, the following account is the most credible. As Dr. Fakhrizadeh's car was driving down the boulevard, his car came under attack from gunmen mounted on two motorcycles moving in the opposite direction of the leading scientist's car. As the gunmen on motorcycles approached Dr. Fakhrizadeh's car, they opened fire. Meanwhile, a semi-truck parked on the side of the road on Fakhrizadeh's side and packed with wood suddenly exploded. But the explosion was not as strong or effective as the assassins hoped. However, the explosion forced Dr. Fakhrizadeh out of his car, where he was struck by at least three bullets. One of Fakhrizadeh's bodyguards, possibly traveling on a trailing vehicle, tried to shield the leading scientist, and he too was hit by bullets and gravely wounded. Following a short outburst of gunfire, the terrorist quickly fled the scene by traveling down the boulevard and exiting Absad. Contrary to reports, the terrorist had not turned off the small town's electricity supply prior to the attack. The explosion of the semi-truck knocked off the town's power for a brief period. Again, contrary to reports, there were no CCTVs in the vicinity of the attack for the terrorist to deactivate. The closest CCTV is in a square where the town's municipality is situated, and that's several kilometers away from the scene of the attack.
IRGC chief General Salami implies the assassination happened days before the U.S. is driven out of the region, a year from the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani in early January this year. Here are a few lines of his statement on the Fakhrizadeh case. "Our missiles and drones are locked on 20,000 targets. Only Israel knows who and where we might aim for. The second defense or reaction plan is to destroy thousands of carriers of tanks, planes, and equipment. No shot will be aimless and in vain. We warn surrounding countries. Any shot from any point in your countries will be the destruction of the whole area." Israel is a prime suspect, not for no good reason. Israel has the capacity and has done it before. It also has a motive and has the U.S.'s blessing, as I said. I asked people from different walks of life how they felt about a prominent Iranian scientist being assassinated on his own soil.
I have a feeling of sadness, anger, and an obligation for me to avenge the blood of this martyr.
I just feel my condolence for such a loss, and I want to express my compassion to my nation and our society is eager to retaliate. They just want to some retaliation in the same time, in the same way, at the same level.
We witnessed the cowardly assassination, and I think that the heart of every Iranian and the heart of every free man in the world was saddened. The Iranian people and the whole world condemn such acts.
The available evidence shows the enemies behind this incident were the Americans and the Israelis. We expect the government to fully identify the perpetrators of this assassination and to avenge this martyr.
It's noteworthy the Obama administration condemned Israel's earlier assassinations precisely because it knew the murders wouldn't set back Iran's nuclear program, really, but would set back any efforts to negotiate a deal to curb the program. And now, to get back into that nuclear deal, if Biden wins the U.S. election and takes office, he will most likely have to strongly communicate that Israel will incur costs if it continues to carry out attacks in Iran. The 2015 Iran nuclear deal was signed between Iran and the P5 plus one. That's the US, UK, France, Russia, China, plus Germany.
The nation isn't totally unified in how it views the world, but anti-US sentiment among Iranians still definitely exists and is nothing new. It's not hatred for hatred. It began with US interference in Iran's internal matters even before the revolution. And in the past year alone, the Trump administration has reportedly run several joint sabotage operations with Israel against Iran's nuclear facilities.
Also, to assassinate Iranian General Soleimani outside a Baghdad airport early in January, the U.S. relied partly on Israeli intelligence. And earlier this month, Trump himself reportedly raised the possibility of attacking Iran with his top national security advisers. And shortly after, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Arab adversaries of Iran.
This is how they have failed to overthrow the Islamic Republic for the last 41 years. You know, they thought that having Saddam Hussein attack Iran militarily is going to finish the government here. And what they actually did was to prolong the life of the Islamic Republic by creating so many martyrs. And this is what they don't get. They don't understand that the culture here is a culture of martyrdom, a culture of resistance.
Here's what the people thought about whether the loss of another prominent scientist, perhaps the most prominent of those assassinated, would shatter the foundations of Iran's scientific advancement.
Certainly, the scientists who have been martyred have trained many students to follow in their footsteps. Their blood will definitely help us to continue down this path with more strength.
Removing scientists do not lead to deletion of science, and that is a misperception that they have, and they do know that. It just makes us to pursue knowledge much more than before.
What the enemies and ill wishers of the Islamic Republic should know is that this movement and the progress that has been made during the last 42 years will not be stopped by such events, and we will continue on our path and progress further.
Mr. Ruivaran comments on how the murder might affect the nation.
In terror,
one of its aims was to destroy the morale of the people. As we have seen in the past, society regrets the assassination of its own scientists, and I think this creates a spirit of frustration in society. The security organizations in Iran must act quickly and identify those involved in this crime and respond to them to compensate for the psychological impact on Iranian society.
Apart from the fact that Iran has perhaps hundreds of scientists and institutional knowledge enough to carry on regardless of any single scientist, Mr. Fakhrizadeh's importance is now more symbolic and less for current knowledge of the detail of Iran's present scientific programs.
I believe that knowledge cannot be assassinated.
The nuclear or missile knowledge has been localized by Iranian experts. The killing of five other nuclear experts and scientists who were martyred before the signing of the JCPOA did not stop this. The Iranians have gained domestic knowledge that can no longer be stopped.
If it's even possible to excuse Israel's highly probable crime of state terror with the Trump administration's acquiescence, if not complicity, there are those in Israel and the U.S. who see the current maximum pressure policy of U.S. sanctions and threats of attacks on Iran as the only route to stop Iran from expanding its influence, whatever that may mean. The key point is that they think Iran can be controlled by pressure and threats. The five-year history of the JCPOA is enough to prove that theory miserably wrong. The one thing that got Iran to curb its peaceful nuclear program was civility demonstrated in signing that Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or nuclear deal. In return for doing so, nuclear-related economic UN sanctions were to be lifted off Iran. But
they failed to defeat Iran in the fields of hardware and military capabilities, so they opted to focus on the field of software and chaos to eliminate the manifestations of Iran's power, which are its elites and scientists, by the most violent and brutal means, namely terror and assassination. At the same time, while respect for scholars, scientists, and elites has a fundamental place in human nature, for this oppressive order, scientists are perceived as hindrances because they have the knowledge and the enemy knows that they can strengthen their nations.
If partnerships with Israel and Arab states such as Saudi Arabia are to be strategic to the U.S., I'd really reconsider those partnerships, because U.S. strategic partnerships should make the U.S. more secure, not less, to take a page out of responsible statecraft.
Plenty more to be learned and more to be said on the matter, and for that I'll be back in no time. But first, a look at other media outlets to see what they have to say with Shahzad.
Hi, I'm Shahrzad Manoucheri, and we'll be reviewing the latest update on the assassination of Iranian scientists and futile attempts to undermine Iran's progress. Tasnim news agency states ex-CIA head warns of lethal retaliation after assassination of Iranian scientist. Former CIA director John Brennan described the assassination of top Iranian scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh as a criminal act, warning that this could risk sparking a wider conflagration in the Middle East. This was a criminal act and highly reckless. It risks lethal retaliation and a new round of regional conflict, Brennan tweeted on Friday. Iranian leaders would be wise to wait for the return of responsible American leadership on the global stage and to resist the urge to respond against perceived culprits, he added. In an article by Ruda, we see Bernie Sanders states, assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist, reckless, provocative, and illegal. U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders has described the assassination of a high-ranking Iranian nuclear scientist as reckless, provocative, and illegal, and a deliberate act meant to impair the possible incoming American president's foreign policy agenda. Top Israeli officials have not claimed involvement in the assassination. I have no clue who did it. It's not that my lips are sealed because I'm being responsible. I simply have no clue, Israeli Cabinet Minister Tzachi Hanegbi said. That's all for this segment.
Even after the United States of America tried diplomacy, Israel pressed the Trump administration to end U.S. participation in the JCPOA, and that it did in 2018. This meant U.N. sanctions were now reimposed and reinforced on Iran as U.S. sanctions. Tensions between the two states escalated naturally, and escalation of tensions since have brought the U.S. and Iran to the brink of war twice. Strategic partnership to serve one party. In case you're wondering why the U.S. would serve Israel to the disadvantage of its own people, it wouldn't. It's doubtful it would. But Israel has hold over U.S. presidents thanks to AIPAC, the powerful Jewish lobby in America, and now it has an Arab alliance to support it at this end.
The U.S. government and Israel have a strategic alliance with each other. Sometimes America's behavior goes in the direction that it is willing to suffer a lot of losses in order to save the Zionists. The Zionists, on the other hand, are assisting the Americans in the region. In the U.S. strategy, its hegemonic stability is defined by ensuring Israel's security.
I said some in the U.S., Israel, and its apparently newly allied Arabs accuse Iran of expanding its influence in the region. Iran is a millennia-old regional heavyweight and sees itself responsible for maintaining a balance of power in its own region. Do note, the U.S. is over 10,000 kilometers far from this region, and, well, how Israel came about and maintains its presence in the region. Israel is the decades-long entity that rests on occupied Palestine. Also, it's the only entity in West Asia known to have nuclear warheads, hundreds of them. As for its policy of governmental terrorism, let's take a look at some faces from the past. 2010 saw Massoud Ali Mohammadi, a Tehran University professor, assassinated in a pinpoint blast. Also in late 2010, Majid Shahriari, who specialized in neutron transport, met the same fate. Assassins riding motorcycles planted and detonated a C4 bomb on his car door whilst he was driving. He was instantly killed. Fereydoun Abbasi, his fellow nuclear scientist and professor at Shahid Beheshti University, also had a bomb attached to his car and detonated by the killers from a distance. But he and his wife escaped death. They were wounded. In 2011, Dariush Rezai Nejad was gunned down outside his Tehran apartment. He was an electrical engineer doctoral student whose work involved nuclear applications. No time wasted. In 2012 came Mustafa Ahmadi Roshan's turn. Motorbike riders attached a magnetic bomb that tore apart a car carrying him. He was a nuclear scientist working at Iran's main uranium enrichment facility in Natanz. Roshan was in fact set to attend a memorial for Massoud Ali Mohammadi, who was killed in similar fashion. After this latest assassination, it's more likely that should Iran return to the negotiating table, it will return stronger with more demands, not weaker.
Thanks for joining us from the whole team. We'll also be doing a piece on the anniversary of the Soleimani assassination. Bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Epic of 8-Year Holy Defense.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we discussed the implementation of the paragraphs of UN Security Council Resolution 598, after the acceptance of 1975 Algiers Accord. Thus, the Iraqi forces pulled out of the Iranian soil and the POWs were exchanged. Therefore, then, UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Coya put paragraph 6 of the resolution on the agenda, which pertained to the initiator of war and the aggressor. The UN chief, after reviewing the documents of Iran and Iraq, named Saddam as the initiator of the war. The declaration of Iraq as the aggressor was a great victory for the Iranian nation. Paragraph 7 of the resolution was also important. This paragraph explained the damages inflicted upon the two countries. Therefore, due to the determination of the aggressor, it was Iraq which had to pay to Iran. following a series of negotiations between Iran and the UN Secretary General for implementation of paragraph 7 of the UNSC Resolution 598, a UN delegation headed by the Deputy of UN Secretary General, Abdulrahim Farah, arrived in Tehran on May 31, 1991. The delegation took several trips to Tehran within 6 months and traveled to different parts of Iran to take aerial photos and examine the land closely. The UN delegation prepared two detailed reports on the damages caused by Saddam's army and delivered it to the UN chief. Dekoya handed the report and the result on determination of indemnity to the UNSC. According to the report, 5 Iranian provinces had been involved in the war and 11 other provinces were attacked by the Iraqi army. 50 cities and 4,000 villages had also been harmed in the war. Totally, 2/3 of the Iranian population had been subjected to the war. The UN report had made it clear that Iraq had cut 500,000 date palms and had carried out massive destruction on the Iranian soil. The UN delegation estimated the direct damages of Iran to be $99 billion and the indirect losses to amount to $150 billion. But the Islamic Republic of Iran announced its losses to be $1,000 billion. Although the amount of Iran's losses was officially announced by the United Nations, the UNSC Resolution 598 had not designated any mechanism for payment of the losses. Saddam invaded Kuwait 2 years after the end of his war against Iran. This move urged the Western and Arab regimes and media to admit some of the realities that they would not think of revealing even years after the end of the 8-year imposed war. These media confessed that the financial aid of the West to the Ba'athist regime in Baghdad not only contributed to the fire of war, they resulted in myriads of crimes and heavy losses during the war. The London-based Daily Observer, admitting the funneling of financial assistance to the Iraqi regime by the Western and Eastern regimes, wrote on September 23, 1990, that if the Saudi regime, along with Europe and Soviet Union, had not dispatched military forces, equipment and money, Iran would not have sustained that much of losses and damages during the war. Voice of America said on February 12, 1991, that it was Iraq and not Iran that enjoyed massive military and financial foreign helps. These helps enabled Saddam to create a war machine. 8 years later, when ceasefire was set up between the two countries, the Iraqi army exceeded 1 million. This means that the Iraqi dictator had managed to quadruple his military forces within 8 years, while the money for this was secured by the Saudi and Kuwaiti regimes. Not only these two regimes, but the Soviet Union, France, West Germany and Japan, and the United States of America had also assisted the Iraqi regime. Voice of America, in another report on September 28, 1990, disclosed the U.S. effort for removal of the Ba'athist regime in Iraq from the list of the sponsors and supporters of terrorism. It said that in 1983, the U.S. deleted the name of Iraq from the country supporting terrorism. Then suddenly, international credits and commercial helps started to be sent to Iraq. Christian Science Monitor divulged Washington financial credits to the Ba'athist regime and wrote that in the years 1985 to 1990, the U.S. Bank of Exports and Imports granted $260 million credit to Iraq to maintain its needs from the U.S. The Daily put the securing of financial needs of the Iraqi regime by the U.S. in the years 1987 to 1989 at $1 billion. Another part of the confessions were related to the U.S. role in the chemical crimes of the Iraqi regime. British Daily Herald Tribune, quoting from Arthur Schallinger, aide to the former American President John F. Kennedy, wrote on December 17, 1990, that while Saddam was going to launch such an operation, meaning chemical attack, the loans granted by American banks to Iraq for purchasing of agricultural products amounted to $1 billion. In addition to the Western governments, Arab regimes too, threw their full support for Saddam. The Voice of America reported on February 12, 1991, that the Persian Gulf Sheikhdoms secured nearly $30 billion, more than half of Iraq's financial needs. The fabricated Zionist regime's radio revealed on July 23, 1990, that Kuwait had given billions of dollars of aid to Saddam in the war against Iran. It made it clear that Saddam had borrowed approximately $60 billion foreign loans to continue the war against Iran. At least $40 billion of this money had been given by Arab regimes, including Kuwait, which gave $14 billion. Voice of America also said that Kuwait, in order to support Iraq after 1986, overloaded the global markets with oil in a bid to prevent the oil price hike from $15 to $17 per barrel and decrease Iran's oil revenues. Kuwaiti economic expert Fawaz Badr said at a conference in UN on December 7, 1990, that Kuwait had helped Iraq almost $15 billion. He stressed that this support was apart from the assistance in terms of oil. The Saudi regime was another supporter and comrade in crime of the Iraqi dictator Saddam against the Islamic Republic of Iran. The financial assistance of Riyadh to the Ba'athist regime in Baghdad were so high that the Saudi defense minister in those days, Khalid bin Sultan bin Aziz, said, "My country would provide the drinks of the Iraqi army." VOA reported on August 14, 1990, that the Saudi regime had given billions of dollars to Saddam in the war against Iran. Associated Press, too, on the same day, quoting the Saudi monarch Fahd, said, "If Iraq says that it has sacrificed its forces, we have also been involved with money, advanced weapons, and international cooperation." The Saudi state TV, in a report, admitted the regime's financial aids to Iraq, saying, "Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and United Arab Emirates granted their entire financial aids to Saddam during the war." On January 15, 1991, Reuters, quoting Fahd, announced the exact figure of Saudi regime's financial aids to Iraq as $27 billion in form of the military and economic assistance. As for the Western regime's aids to the criminal Iraqi ruler Saddam during the eight-year imposed war, one of the Western media wrote, "One of the NATO bases in the center of France was the place of loading Antonov aircrafts of the Iraqi Air Force. These aircrafts would take cluster bombs, fuses, and radar equipment to Iraq. The French spying apparatuses estimated in 1986 that if Paris would quit its aid to Iraq for 3 weeks, Iraq would be defeated. Thus, during the eight-year imposed war, the Iranian valiant youth fought not only against Saddam's army, but against scores of its supporters in various parts of the world who were complicit in each and every crime that the Iraqi army committed."
Thank you.
Face to Face.
Hello, everyone. I'm Yusuf Jalali, and this is Face to Face. Iran is situated between two strategic bodies of water. On its north, it borders the Caspian Sea, and to its south, it meets the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman. This is exactly why the Islamic Republic of Iran has one of the heavily equipped and strongly manned navies in the world. To get to know more about Iran's navy and where it stands in regional equations, let's talk to commander of the Iranian Army's Naval Force, Rear Admiral Hossein Khanzadi. Welcome to the show. Well, to start with, please give us a brief history about Iran's navy and how and when it was formed.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. If you want to speak about the history of Iran's navy, I think the Iranian navy has gone through a number of stages. If you want to speak about the formation of the Iranian navy, it goes back to roughly 500 years before Christ's birth. To be precise, it was 538 years before Christ was born. It was established during the Achaemenid Empire, and it was a strong navy. It goes back to the era when Iran's territory stretched from the Mediterranean Sea to parts of Asia, including Pakistan, India, and other areas in the Indian Ocean. During that period, Iran had a powerful naval force. However, it was formed based on the demographic composition of the country in that time. Its seamen came from various countries, which back then were under Iran's rule. The majority of the seamen were from Phoenicia, which used to be part of Iran's territory. As we move forward on the timeline and get to the Afsharid dynasty, the navy undergoes some changes. The Qajar era paid less attention to the navy, except for a certain time when two steel vessels joined the country's naval fleet for the first time. One of the two vessels was Persepolis ship. Today, the two ships are kept at a museum. The first Pahlavi took some steps in the naval industry. The second Pahlavi takes some measures to organize the navy. The most outstanding aspect of the Pahlavi period was its reliance on external resources to build up its naval force. In other words, whatever Iran's navy possessed before the victory of the Islamic Revolution depended on other countries. The Iranian navy industry was entirely supplied by mostly Western countries, which either sold their vessels and equipment to Iran or trained Iranian naval forces. With the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, a revolutionary navy stepped into existence, a navy that operated based on religious teachings and the ideals of the Islamic Revolution. If we had relied solely on the foreign come imported naval equipment, our entire naval arsenal would have definitely been decommissioned today. The annals of previous ruling systems in Iran show that the navy had always been unstable. The equipment that the country would import would after some time go out of service because of inappropriate maintenance or inefficient training. Furthermore, inadequate domestic capacities and lack of attention on the part of the former governments reduced the navy to a token force. So in the past, the navy had its ups and downs due to its dependence on foreign resources. Basically, it was after the victory of the Islamic Revolution when the Iranian navy found its way to stability and resilience. And this was achieved by concentrating on national resources and relying on domestic capabilities. In 1979, when the Islamic Revolution emerged victorious, and later on, when different branches of the government gradually took form, the Iranian armed forces and the Islamic Republic of Iran's army in particular decided to develop and organize the navy. The equipment that were purchased before the revolution would have long been decommissioned if the navy was to tread on the same path beaten by previous political systems. This issue gains more significance when we take into account the asymmetric and full-scale war that Iraq imposed on the Islamic Republic in 1980. The war was part of the West's bid to deal a blow to the fledgling revolution, since they were unsuccessful in their attempts to topple the Islamic Republic. They resumed their war from outside the country. This way, they falsely thought that they could mount pressure on the Iranian government and ultimately bring the Islamic Revolution to an end. This was their main objective. So when the war was imposed on Iran, we confronted the entire front of the global hegemony. All countries that were able to assist Iraq pitched in and offered their support in whatever form they could, from ammunition to intelligence and even manpower. They even offered their financial resources to support Iraq. Foreign advisors left Iran. They falsely believed they would leave Iran to come back soon. They thought the advanced and complicated foreign military equipment Iran possessed at the time would soon stop functioning, because back then, foreign advisors controlled everything in our country, and even tightening a single knot required their approval. They were also in charge of maintaining the spare parts. So we've come a long way to get to where we're standing today. During the war, the Navy was tasked with defending Iran's territorial waters. November 28th marks the National Navy Day, and it marks 57 days after Iraq's invasion of Iran. On November 28th, the Iranian Navy gave the Ba'athist regime a hard slap on the face. We rendered their offshore oil platforms inoperative and destroyed a significant part of their naval fleet. The Islamic Republic of Iran Army's Navy then took full control over the sea. This achievement led to the removal of Iraq's full siege of Abadan Peninsula. If the Iraqi forces had maintained their full siege of Abadan from both sea and land, Abadan would have fallen into their control, and the Ba'athist regime of Iraq would have succeeded in implementing its strategy. Iraq suffered a defeat in the very early days of the war. Iran's defense forces achieved successive victories. Abadan was recaptured from Iraq and Khorramshahr was liberated. These were all possible thanks to the successful operations of the Iranian Navy at sea and on the coast.
That's
exactly what I wanted to ask as a second question. All of the achievements that you mentioned during the eight-year Iraqi imposed war against the country came against the backdrop of the toughest sanctions imposed by the United States against the Islamic Republic in a wide range of areas, the military sector being on top of them. How did Iran survive the war despite the sanctions? And even now, how is Iran able to protect its borders despite the toughest sanctions still in place by the United States?
Of course, it was not easy. The sanctions were not imposed only by the United States. Of course, the U.S. took the lead in this issue and spearheaded the sanctions. The European countries then followed the U.S.'s lead. For example, all of our guided missile frigates are French-made, and all of the components installed on those frigates were made based on the latest technologies imported from France before the Islamic Revolution. When the anti-Iran sanctions were put in place, Europeans also jumped on the wagon and imposed sanctions on a range of defense equipment such as fire control systems, artilleries, and missiles. Missiles, radars, fire control systems, and other defense equipment each were purchased from a different country. This was why a multilateral arms embargo needed to be imposed on Iran to encompass all sectors of our defense industry. Each and every country that supplied arms to Iran upheld the sanctions. We had to stand on our own feet, so we directed our focus on our domestic capabilities. And the naval sector received the highest attention. We tapped into capacities in the naval industries complex in Bandar Abbas and other resources we had in Bushehr. Imam Khomeini issued a directive to launch a crusade in the naval sector. The first step was to focus on manufacturing spare parts and components. That's because spare parts were affected worse by the sanctions. Because of the sanctions, we could not provide a new spare part if we needed to replace it for a certain equipment. Take the engine of a vessel, for example. If a vessel operates 24 hours a day, the conditions of its parts, such as generators, deteriorate over time. Any equipment, be it military or civil, such as the engine of a car, when a specific part reaches its expiry date, it needs to be replaced with a new one. And since Iran was no longer able to import new parts, the Navy resorted to the remaining parts stored in warehouses. At the same time, the country started to produce fast-moving parts, all based on domestic capabilities, which were poor at that time. We started by producing spare parts indigenously and advanced to a stage where we were capable of manufacturing destroyers and submarines. As we moved forward, we increased the quality of our spare parts. In the early days, some of the spare parts we produced did not meet the standard level of efficiency. We worked days and nights to make our spare parts up to the mark. Initially, the shelf life of our indigenous spare parts was also so short. Gradually, the alloys changed and the corresponding products grew in performance. We are now at a point where not only do we produce spare parts, but also we manufacture the entire equipment from A to Z. All this was achieved in an atmosphere of self-reliance and trust in our national capabilities.
I would like to know how Iran has managed to achieve this level of self-sufficiency. Over the past years, Iran has unveiled numerous fairly advanced military equipment. In your field of expertise, Fateh submarine is definitely a case in point, which is capable of launching missiles from underwater. How has Iran managed to achieve this level of self-sufficiency despite all of the pressures and restrictions imposed by the U.S.?
Nothing can be achieved easily and effortlessly. Nothing can be achieved through depending on foreign countries. Part of it has to do with the successful macro management of the country. You cannot have a powerful and self-sufficient navy when your economy is weak. There is a principle that says an economy without security is nothing but a mirage. You see the mirage for a moment, and shortly after, you won't. Furthermore, security cannot be achieved without a strong economy. These two concepts are interconnected, like two interlocked chains. Good macro management of the country led to the development of both economic and industrial capabilities. If we want to build a vessel, we'll need to have a marine-grade steel alloy for its hull. A few countries possess the technology to produce such an alloy. Our capability to use special alloys in parts of the vessels lies in the fact that we have advanced industrial capabilities in iron casting and alloy production. In the past years, the Defense Ministry has made commendable breakthroughs. When in 2009, Jamoran destroyer was launched after 10 years of development, the leader said Moch 2 class of the destroyers had to be more advanced than Moch 1 and Moch 3 had to outperform Moch 2. Progress happens gradually. It does not happen overnight. This is especially the case for Iran, which faced tough sanctions on all of its sectors and at the same time was no longer interested in asking other countries for a commodity. If Iran was supposed to stand on its own feet, first and foremost, it needed to develop its industrial capacities. The next step was to rely on the young generation and believe in them. This issue was more evident during the Iraqi-imposed war and even afterwards during the post-war reconstruction period when the youth played a special role in the development of the country. At the same time, Iran developed its universities and established a link between academic centers and the armed forces with the focus on sectors that operate based on technology, like the Navy. We mobilized almost all universities at that time. This is why today we can launch missiles from a submarine and build naval cruise missiles in different ranges. Today, our armed forces, especially the Navy and other units at the Ministry of Defense and Armed Forces Logistics, are at the pinnacle of their military and scientific capabilities to an extent that we are aiming for the production of more advanced equipment.
Well, this coupled with last month's UN Security Council's termination of the arms bans against the Iranian military sector. So this definitely opens the doors for the Islamic Republic to be able to purchase necessary defense equipment or even sell its own indigenously built arms to other countries. Does Iran have any plans to do so?
With regard to Iran, the top decision makers of the armed forces should answer this question. However, if I were to answer this question on behalf of the Iranian Navy, I should say whether the door is open or closed on us, it will not make any difference when it comes to our capabilities. Gone are those days when Iran needed to import a subsurface missile or an engine designed for emergency use. We no longer need to buy the equipment and systems needed for our vessels. Today, it's too late to speak of such issues since we have crossed all those boundaries. Building a destroyer has become a very simple task for us. It used to take up to 15 years to manufacture a destroyer. I dare say Damavand destroyer, which was constructed in 2 years, can now be built in just 1 year without any assistance from other countries. Therefore, the removal of the sanctions and the reopening of the doors will not lead to an inbound flow of weapons to Iran, but there will definitely be an outward flow. We are ready to supply any friend nations that need to consolidate their defensive capabilities to stand against the global hegemony or any other threats. Today, Iran is standing at the peak of its capabilities in the defense sector. So the lifting of the embargoes is not a big deal for the Iranian Navy. I'm certain that this is also the case for other sectors of the country. We have acted upon our leaders' initiatives that instruct us not to pin our hopes on other countries in the defense industry. We have successfully carried out this obligation by focusing on the Iranian youth.
All right, let's move to south of Iran, the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz, one of the most strategic maritime choke points through which 20% of the world's oil is shipped. Iran is in charge of securing that strategic choke point. How has the Islamic Republic managed to establish and ensure security in this very strategic choke point?
That's a good question. The Strait of Hormuz. A significant portion of the world's energy passes through this checkpoint, and the volume of the shipped energy increases with each passing day, since the global demand for energy rises every day. And it's not all about energy. When we speak about oil, we don't mean just fuel. Fuel, perhaps, is the most basic product of oil. An increasing number of industries have begun to turn oil into products with higher added value, so that today you can see the traces of the oil industry in every field. The security of every region has its own custodians. As to the Strait of Hormuz, it's clear which countries are in charge of ensuring its security. And so far, we have not faced any serious instances of insecurity as a result of an inefficient navy of a coastal state. Whenever the region's security was threatened, the issue was dealt with based on international maritime laws and the regulations of the related coastal state. We have acted firmly against anyone who has ever tried to undermine the security of the region. For the time being, the major cause of insecurity in the Persian Gulf is the naval coalition, which has no reasonable justification for its presence in the region. The Persian Gulf is a small body of water. It has been a safe transit route for the world's energy, and no incident of insecurity has been reported so far. Their claims that their presence in the region is to establish security is nothing but an excuse. Their main goal is to protect some of the mercenary regimes in the region. Thanks to the naval forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Persian Gulf, the Sea of Oman, and the Strait of Hormuz are among the safest waterways in the world.
How about fighting the piracy, the pirates that roam around your maritime borders. What countermeasures have you adopted to fight the pirates in your region?
It's really strange to speak of piracy in the era of technology and high-speed data transfer. It's unbelievable that piracy is still